Most people see arms control as a political issue best left in the hands of government leaders. But now many doctors are defining nuclear arms as a health issue because of the incredible destruction and death that a detonated nuclear weapon would cause. With me is Helen Caldicott, the president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, a group of doctors working for nuclear disarmament, trying to warn citizens and doctors and government leaders around the world of the irreversible devastation nuclear war would bring to the planet and all life on it. Dr. Helen Caldicott is a pediatrician, currently on leave from Children's Hospital in Boston and on leave from the Harvard Medical School. She's on leave so that she can devote her full time to anti-nuclear efforts. She's recently organized the Women's Party for Survival, which she'll also be telling us about, and she's planning a march on Mother's Day in Washington, D.C., a march for the end of the nuclear arms race. Helen Caldicott, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You were listening to the last few minutes here in the studio of the talk with Ovi Bogdanov. How does it strike you, listening to someone from the Soviet Union speaking about disarmament on American media?
I think what he said was fascinating and eminently sensible, and it interests me a lot because I visited the Soviet Union 15 months ago with a group of Americans, and at that time they were very uncommunicative, although they were very concerned about the arms race and wanted desperately for SALT II to be ratified. They didn't pose their concern to the American public. So we said to them, for God's sake, be more open with the American press. You underestimate the power of American public opinion. Go on national television. And it seems they may have taken our words somewhat seriously. I see that Georgi Arbatov, who is the head of the Institute for American-Canadian Studies, was going to debate with Bill Moyers and some other people from the State Department, and the State Department have revoked his visa and are sending him back a day or two before that debate. Now, that seems to me quite stupid, because surely the only way to fix relationships is with dialogue. Otherwise, we probably will have a nuclear war, and I think the analogy is a marriage. You don't fix a marriage by standing off and hating each other and not talking, nor do you fix it by blowing it up with TNT. You fix it by moving over and saying, "Hun, what's the matter? Have I been bugging you lately?" "Yes, well, what are the things I've done?" And the person says this, this, and this, and you say, "Well, maybe we can negotiate and I might capitulate a little bit or move towards you or vice versa." And the whole dynamic changes. And after all, international relationships are just mass psychology, and we're all people and we all have the same sort of feelings.
Well, you told the Soviets don't underestimate the power of public opinion, but how much influence do you think public opinion has on the arms race in this country?
Well, it's a good question, I suppose, because although this is a democracy, you'd have to look at it in another way when you look at the arms race, because these weapons have been built in total secret. And until recently, even the nuclear power industry was classified because the reactors were designed to make bombs. And so we've been kept in the dark, and we haven't known that we sort of have, but not the details of where the money's going and who's making the bombs, like General Electric and Union Carbide and Bendix Washing Machine and Singer Sewing Machine, etc. And we pay our money in blind ignorance. And I don't think any of us really want to be protected by mutually assured destruction and annihilation.
Since the last time you were here, which was, I believe, November, possibly December, there's, I think, been even more discussion about the possibilities of limited nuclear war. What do you think is causing all the talk about it, both on the part of citizens who are very, very worried and getting very nervous, and on the part of the government, who seems to right now feel relatively confident that a nuclear war is something that could be winnable?
Mm. Well, I don't know where these characters came from who are in the administration right now. But they're certainly not acting in a sane fashion, nor in a medically ethical way. And even Haig said during his Senate confirmation hearings that a limited nuclear war would not remain limited. Secretary of Defense Brown stressed that again and again. Carter said it. Brezhnev said it. And I don't think Reagan's referred to it. It's obvious that it can't remain limited. So, because what if America sent over 100 intercontinental ballistic missiles and they were going towards the missile silos in Russia? How do the Russians know where they're targeted, number one? How do they know there are no more coming? And what are they going to do to retaliate? They'll send everything back and vice versa. I mean, you just have to understand the psychology of people to know how they'll react. So talk about a limited nuclear war is patently mad. Yet we proceed, and even if there was a limited nuclear war, say Both sides used only 10% of the nuclear arsenals they have. According to the National Academy of Sciences in 1975, it would destroy 80% of the ozone layer in the northern hemisphere, it's predicted, and 30 to 40% in the southern hemisphere. Now, it's thought by some that if only 20% was destroyed worldwide of the ozone layer, that could blind every organism on Earth. That means there'd be no bees to pollinate the crops, there'd be no birds, the mammals would die. That would be the end of most life on Earth. That's a very, very small limited nuclear war. So every way you look at it won't remain limited. If you did have one, it would be devastating. Is blatantly, medically unethical.
You've been continuing to travel around the world, in part trying to organize doctors and to try to get doctors to participate in this preventive medicine campaign that you're on. I think I read recently that Brezhnev's doctor was speaking with you or maybe joining the group.
Well, what happened was there's a group of doctors, and I'm in them, called the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. And 2 weeks ago we met at Ely House, doctors from 11 countries, including 17 doctors from the Soviet Union, including Eugene Chazov, who is Leonid Brezhnev's cardiologist. And they were senior physicians from the Soviet Union and senior physicians from all the countries, including deans of medical schools here. And it was interesting that we compared data about the medical effects of nuclear war, and there wasn't any difference. We all totally agreed on the data that, you know, after a full-scale nuclear exchange, it's quite probable that within 1 month, 90% of Americans would be dead, 90% of Russians would be dead, 90% of Europeans would be dead, English, etc., and civilization as we know it would be totally destroyed. There'll be absolutely nothing we as physicians can offer the survivors, as we will probably be dead too. There will be no drugs, no hospital beds. Disease will be rampant as the dead bodies breed resistant bacteria, which are more lethal, and our bodies are affected by the radiation, so our immune mechanism is depleted to fight infection, starvation, sunburn, radiation sickness, terrible injuries, and millions of cases of burns. There are only 2,000 burn beds in the whole of the United States who can treat acutely ill burns. I mean, from a medical point of view, there was one doctor, a very senior man, who's a very conservative man, who was listening to all these papers that were presented by Nagasaki physicians who lived through the bombing and Soviet physicians, and at one point he had tears rolling down his cheeks. That's how we feel.
Do political differences enter the conversation when you're talking with Soviet doctors?
Not at all. We're all doctors. See, we all took the Hippocratic Oath. This is not a political issue, nuclear war. This is a medical issue. And this is our area. It's not the area of politicians to have a nuclear war. It is our area as physicians. And we would advise the politicians, all politicians, and incidentally, the politicians are our patients, all of them. Even Brezhnev's doctor said that. We would advise them that they don't have a nuclear war because it's biologically unacceptable and will destroy most of the human beings on Earth. We are an endangered species, and so are all other species on Earth.
I guess one of the things that immediately becomes political is if you agree to disarmament, how do you go about it?
Well, that's not terribly difficult. At the moment, there are no negotiations going on at all. And as I said, you don't fix a marriage with TNT, nor do you fix a terminally ill planet by blowing it up. To give you an example of what I think, for instance, when Russia did that stupid thing by going into Afghanistan for various reasons, what should have happened was that President Carter should have hopped on a plane, flown quickly over to Moscow and said to Brezhnev, what on earth did you do that ridiculous thing for? We have a terminally ill planet and we definitely don't want to blow it up. Are you annoyed with us? Yes. Why are you annoyed with us? You haven't signed SALT II. We've signed it. We really want to get on with disarmament. You're about to arm China. We're more frightened of China than we are of you because there are a billion Chinese on a long common border. You've surrounded us with your missiles. All around Russia, there are countries with American missiles pointed into the Soviet Union. You've disorganized our southern border in Iran. You're going to place cruise missiles in Europe, which are unverifiable, and once they're deployed, that'll be the end of arms control, SALT talks and detente, whatever, you know. And then Carter should have stayed with him for 2 weeks, getting to know the person, having a relationship, and compromising on both sides, not without heavy discussions and some arguing, I'm sure, but agreeing that they would negotiate and pursue a sane policy so that we won't blow up all the children in the world.
There's been a lot of articles recently in Time Magazine, the New York Times Magazine sanctioned. Major magazines have been writing about your group and about other efforts towards disarmament. What have you thought about the recent media coverage? Of course, I don't know how much time you've been in the country and how much time you've had to read any of it.
Well, it's not enough yet. It's just starting, and I think journalists are just starting to become aware of what we're talking about, and that's stimulating them to write. What we've been doing for the past 20 years as a people is practicing psychic numbing, pushing the reality into the back of our mind, and practicing what animals do when threatened with a life-threatening situation, displacement activity, pretending it's not happening and doing a lot of extraneous, irrelevant things. Even working hard at your job, getting promotions, writing good papers, feeding the children good foods, all those activities are irrelevant when we realize that many scientists now are predicting that we won't survive the next 10 years. And I personally, knowing a lot about this and really examining this current administration's policies, etc., and the present technology which is being developed, seriously doubt if we'll get through the next 4 years if we don't all start doing something. And that's the hope, because none of us have really done anything yet.
How have you been monitoring the new administration, and what are some of the specific actions or specific quotes that you found most alarming?
Well, Richard Pipes, who is a Soviet advisor to the National Security Council, said the other day, I'm not quoting, but to paraphrase him, if Russia doesn't change from communism to capitalism, he implied there would be a nuclear war. Now, the White House and the State Department reprimanded him, but they did not fire him, which means he probably represents their policy. Other advisors to this administration are saying that we must psychologically prepare for a nuclear war and that it is possible to fight and win a nuclear war, which is just so medically unethical and so wrong and so evil that we all should be passionately screaming at the top of our lungs if we want to survive. And then recently, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War wrote a letter to President Reagan and Chairman Brezhnev outlining the medical consequences of such a war. Actually, it's not a war, it's annihilation. And it was sent through the State Department, and one high official received it, and he said, oh, he said, that group, they're for peace and they're against nuclear war. He said they don't represent this administration's policies at all.
When you go armed with all the statistics that you have and information about everything from spontaneous death to burns and the destruction of the ozone layer, and say you're meeting with a doctor who says, no, this group isn't for me, how do they disengage from you? What arguments have you been offered by people who don't want to work for disarmament?
We don't get that reaction, you know, from doctors.
You don't?
Because we all took the Hippocratic Oath, and we all deal with life and death most days. We understand the value of every single human life. We never compromise in our medical practice, not ever. We don't compromise. And so when I go around to the hospitals and give lectures, which are called grand rounds, there may be some resistance sometimes from the radiologists or the surgeons because they think I'm going to attack X-rays, which I don't. But when I lay out the whole medical scenario of a nuclear war, there's not a single question. Now, some don't join Physicians for Social Responsibility immediately. They think about it, and it stimulates their reading, and they converse with their peers, and eventually many of them send in membership forms. We get about 20 or 30 new members who are physicians each day now, and we had no members 2 years ago. We now have over 4,000 physicians. And recently, the American Medical Association wrote a letter to President Reagan warning him of the medical consequences of nuclear war and asking that he meet with senior members of the American medical profession to discuss this issue.
Has he ever done that?
Who? Reagan?
Reagan, yeah.
No, I don't think they received a reply. But, you know, his doctor the other day sent a message to the International Physicians meeting saying that he supports what we're doing.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Have you had the chance to talk with him directly?
Not yet. But also the president of the Californian Medical Association, who Dr. Joseph Boyle, who apparently knows President Reagan quite well, was moderating one of the sessions at our symposium on the medical consequences of nuclear war in San Francisco last November, and he was profoundly concerned too. So we find as we get more and more deans of medical schools involved and senior people in the medical profession, this is a very credible issue, and it's a very conservative issue too, because we're talking about conserving human life.
What about Hague's doctor?
Well, we must find out who he is. I have to get down, and I'm doing the commencement at the George Washington School of Medicine this year. I suppose he won't be there, but gradually the word filters around. We need to get to these doctors, however, very fast, and I'm well aware that all the senators and congressmen have doctors down there at Bethesda Naval Hospital or wherever they go, and all those doctors must be spoken to too, because most of them are practicing psychic numbing as well.
You're forming or have just formed a new organization called the Women's Party.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about what it is.
Well, after Afghanistan, I was watching television one night and I saw Secretary of Defense Brown testifying before the Senate, and he said, if Russia does so-and-so, we'll use tactical nuclear weapons against Russia. I'd never, ever heard, ever, an American official say that overtly, publicly. And we all know, and he knows too, that one tactical nuclear weapon going off against the Soviet Union could initiate the Holocaust. I was so nauseated, I went to bed, I couldn't do the washing up, and I just collapsed. I was very profoundly concerned for several days. And then I thought, what force is there out there that's as yet untapped in the country? And I realized as I travel around the country talking to large groups of people, it's the women who uniformly come forward crying. And I think it's because we have babies that we really feel this very passionately. And we have a lot of emotion. We're in touch with our intuition. And strangely enough, the industrial era has produced a kind of dispassion amongst us, so that if you show any emotion, they say, well, she's not credible because she's emotional. And the reason for that is if you're doing a scientific experiment and you inject emotional bias, you disturb your data. Or if you have a dying patient and you become subjectively involved, you may not be able to treat the patient objectively. But this is a different issue, because we're moving towards our annihilation in a dispassionate way. And if we can harness the passions of the women, and I mean all the women, the right to lifers, the Phyllis Schlafly's, and the everybody, all together, grandmothers, aunts, mothers, high school girls, college students, we'd have a powerful force. And I think the liberation movements come just in time, so we know what our power is now. And I'm not saying that excludes any gentlemen. Any gentlemen who want to come with us, that's terrific. And so my concept was originally, if we organize women around the country, millions of them, they hold town meetings in their towns, and they invite the doctors from Physicians for Social Responsibility to address the meeting and lay out the medical effects of nuclear war. In other words, we're an educational party. That churches should have sermons every Sunday about nuclear war from the doctors. That the synagogue should, the PTAs, the Rotary Clubs, the Republican Women's Group, etc., etc., etc. And this would then break down the fear of not knowing enough about it, not feeling confident you can understand it, because it's fairly easy to understand. What the Pentagon does is use language which confuses us. And we do that too. The physicians use language so you don't know what's wrong with you. And that's dishonest. And what we have to do is simplify the language so people can understand exactly what's happening. And it's not hard. It's been going on for a long time, and there's a lot to learn, but it's not hard to learn it. And I could also suggest, if people want to know some basic stuff, they could buy my book called Nuclear Madness, which is now out in Bantam in all the shops. So what we've organized is that on Mother's Day, May 10th, which was founded by Julia Ward Howes as a day of peace during the Franco-Prussian Wars, we will all assemble on the steps of the Congress, dressed in our Sunday best, with lots of babies and children, and if you don't have a baby, borrow one. And we'll march with American flags to the White House, where at Lafayette Park, I'll address the crowd about the medical effects of nuclear war. Dr. Benjamin Spock will talk about the future of our babies. Randall Forsberg, who knows intimately the arms race and who generally beats the generals when she debates them about this, will speak. She's a mother too. Then the next day we'll reassemble on the steps of the Congress at 10 a.m. and everyone will have made pre-arranged appointments with their congressmen and legislators. You go to your own representatives and take your babies with you, and you put the babies on the desk of the senator and say, "Senator, sir, why are you not representing the life of this child?" And they're overtly not. And you must know a few basic facts first, so you read my book, and you also call the Women's Party for Survival. We'll send you more information. And the number to call is 617-864-6... Hang on, I've got to look
it
up.
I have it here. It's 864-1656. It's area code 617-864-1656, and I'll give that again a little later. And if you're just tuning in, my guest is Helen Caldicott, President of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and she's on a leave now from Children's Hospital in Boston, where she's a pediatrician, and from the Harvard Medical School, so that she can devote her full-time activities for her work in nuclear disarmament. And again, if you're joining us in the middle, she sees nuclear disarmament as being the most important medical issue, because if you're interested in preventive medicine, she says, surely the first thing you want to do is to make sure that the world doesn't become completely destroyed through the detonation of nuclear weapons. So it seems to me that in a way you're trying to reach a broad group of women, including women who might not usually turn out for political events.
Yeah, it's interesting. Women are calling us in Boston. They're saying, "I've never organized a march before. I don't know what to do." Now, they're just the women we want. Suburban women who just have never done anything before, because they come in with new ideas, and the passion that they have for their babies to survive is the sort of passion we want to mobilize.
So how are you trying to reach people?
Well, I'm traveling around the country for the next 5 weeks doing a tour to speak to doctors and doing a lot of media stuff, talking to women all over the country. We're mobilizing them like that. There's a film about me called 8 Minutes to Midnight, which shows me rushing around the world doing my thing. But apparently that turns people on too. They come in pro-nuclear and go out anti-nuclear. And that can be obtained by calling that number for the Women's Party for Survival. There was also an article about me in the Boston Globe recently, which we got several hundred calls from suburban women wanting to move. I feel there's a changing consciousness that goes along with both education that the physicians are doing and also with the fear that, you know, this administration is overtly talking about having a nuclear war. And I think the other thing is we must confront the scientists who are getting away with sheer potential genocide by doing this. And they don't take a stand because they don't think about the consequences of what they're doing. They're scared their grants from the Pentagon will be cut off. And what they're doing is creating, simply, our global gas oven.
Have you gotten any response from anti-abortion groups, groups who call themselves pro-life?
Yeah, some of them want me to come and talk to them. So that's very good. A woman called in today, however, though, who was anti-abortion and said doctors murder babies and she thinks she'd rather be dead than red and we should probably have a nuclear war and kill everyone. So that seemed a bit strange. But I think most people who are pro-life are obviously against nuclear war and are a natural constituency, and I agree with them.
I've been reading about survivalists, you know, people in, I think the last feature I heard was about a group in California who were, I guess, getting a lot of canned goods and learning nuclear war survival techniques. What do you think of the survivalists?
Oh, I think they're sad because they're ignorant. You know, a 20 megaton bomb dropping on a city would kill everyone within a 20-mile radius, both from radiation and blast and trauma and burns. And even if you were in a shelter, you'd be asphyxiated because the firestorm would be so big you'd die from lack of oxygen. And every town and city in this country with a population of 25,000 people or more is targeted, so they say, with a nuclear weapon. So there are very few untargeted areas, and it will only take about half an hour to an hour to complete this nuclear holocaust if they decide to hold one. And even if you're in a rural area that's not targeted, you'd have to be listening to your radio to know that you should run to the shelter. And you'll have to run very fast because it only takes about 20 minutes to happen. And when you get in there, you probably won't have had time to collect your children with you or your friends or family. And you can't come out for 2 weeks because the radiation would be so intense that you would die. And if you come out in 2 weeks, there'd literally be millions of dead, decaying bodies with all the diseases we now control rampant, polio, plague, dysentery. Much of the ozone layer will be destroyed, so people would die of sunburn and develop blindness, and they'd die of starvation, and there'd be no doctors to help, etc., etc. So that, I don't know if I said that, we think that within a month after a full-scale nuclear attack, 90% of Americans will be dead, and many will die soon afterwards. So that it's a little sad. It's like people taking sugar tablets when they've got cancer or something like that.
So you think that the survivalists are really off track by
giving up their canned goods? Oh, yeah, they're just totally, totally medically ignorant, yeah.
The nuclear clock is set at 4 minutes to midnight, and on your brochure about the Mother's Day March, you have a few pictures of it. What exactly is the nuclear clock, and how do they figure out midnight is, by the way,
doomsday,
right? Mm. What is it, and how is it figured out?
Okay, well, that clock is on the bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, the cover, and that bulletin was started during the days of Einstein, and the clock has only moved 10 times since 1945. When Russia got the hydrogen bomb, it was actually at 2 minutes to midnight. During the years of detente, it was at 9 minutes to midnight. After Afghanistan, it was moved to 7, and January this year, it was moved to 4.
What was the cause of the move?
Well, it's fairly obvious, I think. The election, the fact that SALT II is dead, the cruise missile deployment in Europe, which will stop the arms control process because those missiles are unverifiable, the
Afghanistan
invasion... Well, cruise missiles are very small strategic weapons. Strategic weapons are those that go from continent to continent. Tactical weapons are those that are flown in a plane and just dropped at short distances. They're both the same thing. They're bombs. Same effect. But they're delivered differently. So the words are euphemistic, and they're sort of like Nixon language. They're meant to confuse rather than clarify things. Now, the cruise missiles are intercontinental. They go from Europe to Russia. And they're so small they can be hidden on the back of trucks or in sheds. So the satellite can't pick them up. Now, most strategic weapons are so big that they can be verified by the satellite photographing their silos, you see. So once the cruise missiles are deployed, there will be no adequate verification, and therefore that will stop any arms control negotiations or SALT talks or detente. And that's why we've been able to have SALT talks, because each side can verify what each other's doing and you don't have to base anything on trust. And the reason why SALT II hasn't been passed by this country is that for the first time there's parity in strategic weapons. Each side have an equal number, so to speak. And always before, America's been ahead. Not that it really matters, because America can overkill every Russian person 40 times and Russia can overkill every American person 20 times. So it's sort of silly language anyway. But because the weapons are verifiable, it was okay, and there was parity. But apparently a lot of people now in the Senate and the Congress and the administration still want America to be superior. The issue of superiority is stupid when Russia can kill every person here 20 times and vice versa. So, you know, in medical terminology, this language is overtly insane. Yet we tend to sort of go along with it. We rationalize it, you know, but when you look at it in truth, using a sort of moral perspective, it makes no sense at all.
So getting back again to the nuclear clock, it's set at 4 minutes to midnight. If how seriously do you take that?
Very. To give you my gut reaction, and I know a lot about it because I study it all the time, I, at the moment, will be pleased if we have another summer. Now, that sounds terrible and everyone's going to feel very depressed. And I would say to you that it's not appropriate to feel psychologically comfortable now anyway, and we all should be pretty depressed. And we should be grieving. It's as if I've told people they have cancer. But only by going through the profound depression and anger will we be motivated to do something. Now, people can feel depressed, I think, understandably, only if they've done everything they can to stop this. And what you have to do to stop it is actually change the course of your life. You probably may or may have to give up your job, but certainly you must devote much more of your time to stopping this. People can say, well, what can I do? This country's a vacuum. A few people vote every 4 years. You'll find if you start moving, using the media, the television, the letters to the editor going and bugging your congressmen and senators that there are so many things to be done. There are weapons industries in every town and city of this country pumping out nuclear weapons and the delivery systems and satellites, etc. There are so many things that can be done. Of course we can save the planet. But we have to really get moving because things are critical.
How would you compare the movement in America to the movement going on in different countries in Europe?
Well, I've just been to Europe and there are 300 companies in Britain selling fallout shelters. The Europeans are terribly worried because they see the cruise missile decision as being a sort of cynical ploy by America to have a war between America and Russia on European and Russian soil and exclude America. Of course, that won't happen, because the Russian missiles are also targeted at America as well. But they're terribly concerned. There's really a very large movement now. And I started the movement of physicians off in England. It's growing rapidly. In fact, The Lancet, a leading medical journal, carried an editorial about it after I left. And I started doctors off in West Germany and Holland working against this. And there are French doctors too. But the whole European population are worried. There are large articles in the newspapers most days about the medical and political ramifications of a nuclear war. There's much more consciousness, and I'm sure it's because only recently did they suffer a most shocking war, and most of them remember that very vividly, just like the Russians remember the war.
So I guess right now the main action that you're doing is the Women's Survival Party and the march that you have organized for Mother's Day, which is May 10th. For anyone who's interested in attending that, is there a start time and a place to show up first?
Sure. You all go to the steps of the Congress at noon on May 10th, which is Sunday, Mother's Day, and you assemble there and you wear your best clothes and you bring lots of babies, and we march at 1 o'clock to the White House where there'll be speeches. And the next day you make appointments right now with your legislators and you go, and we spend the whole day lobbying on the Hill and the Congress and the Senate on Monday, May 11th. The other thing I'm doing though is really working hard with the physicians, because I'm president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. We've got 4,000 doctors now. I hope to have about 10,000 by the end of the year. That's really moving very rapidly. We've got 37 chapters all around the country. I'm not the only doctor. We've got lots and lots of doctors now doing exactly what I'm doing, talking to people about the medical effects of nuclear war.
Okay, if you'd like any more information on the Women's Survival Party or on the march that's planned for Mother's Day, you can call on this. This is a Boston number, area code 617-864-1656. And again, that's area code 617-864-1656. If you'd like to read anything by Helen Caldicott, her recent book published in paperback is called Nuclear Madness. And perhaps an address or phone for Physicians for Social Responsibility?
Yeah, the address is Box 144, Watertown, Mass, 02172. Box 144, Watertown, Mass, 02172. And the telephone number is 617-924-3468. 617-924-3468. Now, we have a lot of literature, films, video, cassettes, slideshows that you can use to better educate yourself. There's one specific book you probably all should read called Counterforce Syndrome, how this country is moving rapidly towards a first strike where they hope to knock out all the Soviet missiles, which is very silly medically because the fallout will kill millions of Americans if they do that.
Well, Helen Caldicott, I know you've been working very hard. Thank you very much for spending some of your time with us this afternoon on Fresh Air. I've been speaking with Dr. Helen Caldicott, and she's a pediatrician, and again, she's on leave from her work at Children's Hospital in Boston and the Harvard Medical School, because as the president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, she wants to spend all of her time now working for nuclear disarmament. And recently, she organized the Women's Survival Party, and through that group, she's organizing a Mother's Day March in Washington, D.C., and that's Mother's Day, May 10th. And again, the phone number, if you'd like any more information about the march, is area code 617-864-1656. And for information about Physicians for Social Responsibility, area code 617-924-3468. Well, that's about it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. And this is what's coming up tomorrow at 2 o'clock. My guest will be John Arthur, who writes about new American realist painters. He'll be with us at 2, and then after that, Steve Tetsukawa will be with us, and he makes independent movies about Asian Americans. He feels that commercial movies haven't done a very realistic job in their portrayal of Asian Americans. Fresh Air's film critic Bill Van Wert will be with us at 3:30 tomorrow afternoon, so I hope you can join us then. It's a minute and a half to 5 o'clock, all things considered, coming up from National Public Radio. Jay Goldman has been our technical director this afternoon. Contributing today was Francis Davis and Nick Peters. Production assistance provided by Maeve McGoran. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Danny Miller. My name's Terry Gross. I hope you have a very good evening. Thanks for listening.